This is the Young Farmers Podcast. I'm Lindsay Lesher-Shute. Last week, Hurricane Florence devastated the Carolinas and made a big impact on farmers. Today, I'm speaking with Davon Goodwin. Davon is a grape farmer and also the manager of the Sand Hills Agricultural Innovation Center in Rockland, North Carolina. We talk about what happened to his farm in the storm and what's next. But before we get to Davon, the Farm Bill is due to expire on September 30th. So I called up Ryan McCrimmon from Politico, the current writer for Morning Agriculture, to give us an update. So what's happening this week with Farm Bill negotiations? We just have a few days now to make a deal. Seems like it's not going to happen.
No, that's what we're thinking. If they don't get it done this week, which is pretty clear that they're not going to, it could be a little while before they actually get a final Farm Bill passed. And then there's a whole other question of what happens in the midterm elections and how that will affect the Farm Bill talks afterwards.
Yeah, what's the calculus on that for Democrats? I mean, if they do retake the House, like what do you think their strategy might be post-election should they be in the majority?
I would think that they'll still want to get it done in December as opposed to sort of starting from scratch and like writing their own Farm Bill. If they don't do it by December, if they wait until January, if that's a whole new Congress. So the process technically has to sort of start from scratch.
Again,
They'll have to reintroduce the legislation. So that's a lot of extra hurdles to go through if they don't finish in the lame duck session. So my assumption would be that they somehow get a deal by then. But if Democrats, do take the House, they may still want a deal in December, because, it's less likely that the Senate would flip. So they'll still be having to make a deal with a Republican controlled Senate. So it's not like they'd have all the power if they just wait until January to write any sort of farm bill they want. They would still have to negotiate with the Republican Senate and, of course, President Trump. So I think there's still a deal to be made somewhere in the middle. I would guess that happens in December, but we'll have to wait and see.
So SNAP is the major sticking point. And of course, there are some programs that will be stranded, including this Beginning Farm and Rancher Development Program after the September 30th deadline, if there is not an extension. Are you hearing members talk about, these stranded programs as something that they're worried about?
I would say they are worried about it, but they're also, I think, kind of resigned to not getting a deal at this point. For whatever reason, they sort of don't think there's as much urgency now as there will be before the end of the calendar year to finish before January.
And why is Conaway, who is cheering him on to stay strong and negotiate? Like, where do you have a sense of where that comes from? I mean, because, Stabenow and Roberts are more or less in lockstep. They passed the Senate bill with sort of not consensus, but broad support,
right,
in the Senate, bipartisan support. Conaway only had Republicans voting on the House version of the Farm Bill. Like, where is that coming from? I assume some pressure is on him too, just from home, saying, let's get this done.
I think that he would say that is really the priority, is getting this done for farmers. But I think, to your question of who's sort of spurring on this push for work requirements for SNAP, is really just sort of the House Republican conference. I mean, that's sort of one of the differences in general between the House and the Senate, is the Senate is always sort of forced to compromise more and have more bipartisan approaches, and the House is much more controlled by the majority. And so in this case, they don't really want to back down on this thing that's a huge priority for their party.
And is the sense that post-election, that Stabenow and Roberts will have a stronger negotiating position post-election?
Could be. It depends how the elections turn out. I mean, if Republicans hang on to the House, I think they will be emboldened, because I think there's a lot of people right now who are sort of assuming that Democrats will win the House. And I think if they don't, I think that'll definitely sort of harden House Republicans' positions. And so at this point, I don't think it's safe to say that Conaway or the Republicans would back down on their push for work requirements.
And on top of all of this, we have hurricane relief right? And farmers in crisis in North Carolina. And right. we also have new tariffs. So farmers are just, they're in a really, really tough position. So I guess starting with the tariffs, there are new tariffs that were put in place yesterday, retaliatory tariffs from both sides, U.S. on China and China on the U.S. How do those tariffs compare to what's been put in place previously or up to now, up to this point?
So the extent of it is it's exponential how many more tariffs there are now. I mean, we went from the U.S. imposing about 53 billion tariffs on about 53 billion worth of Chinese goods to now it's more than 250 billion. And the Chinese retaliated with another 60 billion on U.S. products. And that, you know, now basically every food and agricultural product is covered by those tariffs. So things are certainly not getting any better on the tariff front. And the Trump administration is trying to offset some of the damage with their trade relief program. But that is not, it's not going to make up at all for the full damage of the tariffs.
Yeah, so I'm always surprised when I hear farmers say that they, you know, they're 100% behind the president, and some of them are bearing the brunt of this trade war, right? Commodity producers in particular. Is that the idea that some of these producers that are still in support of the are in support of these policies, but really feeling the pain of these policies, they are hoping that at the end of it, we're going to get a better deal.
Yes.
Is there a better deal to be struck on some of these commodities? Like, was there a bad deal before now?
That is definitely what a lot of farmers are hoping for, is that, you know, they sort of trust Trump that in the end, this will pay off, you know, short term pain for long term gain. It's sort of unclear if how much, let's say, fallout there will be from the president's tariff policy. There's some concern, I think, among Republican groups that farmers will their support for the president will be lowered because of these policies, even if it's in smaller numbers than you might expect. That could obviously, you know, in such a tight, contentious midterm season, that, you know, any sort of drop off in support could be decisive in certain races. So that's, you know, that's one of the biggest issues. And that, you know, you see USDA rolling out their trade aid plan. Will that be, you know, will that tide over some folks who are really feeling the pain right around election season, coincidentally? And so, you know, this is one of the biggest issues to watch in terms of, you know, real policy and also the politics of it.
You know, At first I really wasn't aware that the U.S. is essentially borrowing money to buy these commodities and provide aid to these farmers. And that money could very well be borrowed from China, right? So is that like,
right.
Is that a conversation that's happening, like about, like, is what's really going on here? Or
yeah.
Are farmers just like very grateful that they have this support?
I think farmers in general are glad to have it, even though I think most will say that it's not, you know, it's not nearly enough. But to your question of, is this sort of just like a bailout from, there was some criticism of that from the beginning, but that's, I think that's one of the points that's sort of been, people have sort of moved on from that, it seems like, in the past couple of weeks.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely difficult to hear, like just in terms of who needs a bailout, like, is it poor people on SNAP benefits, right? Or mm-hmm. is it farmers who are dealing with this terrible trade situation? I mean, it's a very complicated.
Yeah.
Okay. So lot of stuff in the works this week. Are there going to be ongoing negotiations? Will there be any further meetings of the conference committee on Farm Bill?
I don't think there'll be any formal public conference meetings, mm-hmm. but the leaders of the two committees, the big four, as we call them, I think they'll basically be in touch every day, I would assume, until at some point they'll just agree that they're not going to get it done. And I think you are looking at after the elections to December, maybe.
And how, I'm just wondering at this stage in the game, like how dug in is the president, like on these work requirements, and how involved is the administration in these negotiations, or are they not yet?
I would say they are involved, but I think the big four leaders of the committees are really driving the talks. I don't know exactly if the work requirements issue will be sort of a deal breaker for the administration, just because the president has sort of tweeted out that that was an imperative. It doesn't mean that they wouldn't sign a farm bill that had less than what he and House Republicans are seeking, especially because obviously the administration knows that the the agricultural community is one of their main bases of support, and I think they're going to really want to help them out. But it's really hard to predict. Trump, as you know, is very unpredictable, and we'll have to see. You know, I would watch his Twitter account for where he stands
right
on as things go along.
Okay. Well, Ryan, thank you so much for this update. This is really helpful. And
Oh, very, very happy to be here.
Talk to you soon. Thanks so much.
Take care.
Thanks, Ryan. If you want to take action on the farm bill, it's pretty easy. You just text FARM to 40649. That will sign you up for the National Young Farmers Coalition's Action Network and will text you when major votes are happening and give you quick links to take action on farm programs that support sustainable agriculture, young farmers, small farmers, and of course, food security.
Hi, I'm Emily from Three Springs Farm in Oaks, Oklahoma. I've been a member of the National Young Farmers Coalition since 2011 because I believe in having representation in Washington for young farmers. For $35 a year, you can join too. In addition to being part of a bright and just future for agriculture in the United States, you'll also get discounts like 10% off So True Seed and 10% off Farm Tech. To join, go to youngfarmers.org.
Now on to my conversation with Davon. So Davon, tell me, what was the impact of Florence, of the hurricane on your farm, on your existing farm that you've downscaled a bit this year, looking to transition as well as the new property that you are about to purchase?
Yeah, so on the existing property that we have now, the wind was catastrophic. I mean, we probably lost about 40% of our grapes. So our grapes right now are sitting on the ground rotten, which is not good, obviously. So we had a huge amount of wind, and then we had, a ton of rain. And so the wind, once our grapes are so big and so heavy that if we just had rain, we may have made it out okay. But with the rain plus the wind, it wasn't going to be good. So we actually lost a lot of trunks. The wind was so severe that it broke a lot of trunks in half, and it took a lot of trunks off the trellis line. And so we have rows and rows of grapes just lying on the ground now. It felt like the wind just sat over us for days upon days. It was a very, very slow-moving hurricane. Compared to all the rest of the hurricanes that I've been in, this one was just slow. It just seemed like it didn't go anywhere. And we just got pounded and pounded with the wind and the rain. And so once the wind kind of got us, then, our vineyard was, half of it was underwater. And so that's definitely not good. We had a lot of trees fall. A lot of big trees fell around the farm. None of them fell on the trellis or the vineyard part. But a lot of them fell on a lot of the fence lines. But we did get a chance to go out there. We seen that most of our grapes were on the ground. Because before the hurricane, we were probably maybe 50 to 60% done, like harvested our crops. But I mean, we still had a tremendous amount of grapes left. And so economically, it was pretty devastating.
Yeah.
We will probably cover our costs, but I mean, we obviously want to do better than that. So this is one of the problems. And, when we leased in this land, I didn't have crop insurance, which moving forward, we will definitely have that. With the weather being so sporadic, as a young farmer, you better have crop insurance.
Why haven't you bought crop insurance previously?
A couple of reasons. I kind of hate to say this, but I haven't done the best record, even as I needed to. I haven't really done a big job of keeping track of my yields, keeping track of, you know, how many pounds we harvest and all that. And so, but moving forward, you know, is definitely something that, you know, as we start to spend even more money on our farming enterprise, we definitely look at having crop insurance.
Do many of the farmers around you who are impacted have crop insurance?
In my area, we are still into tobacco. So we are still tobacco producers still. And so a lot of those guys got wiped out completely. They had crop insurance. And so that will definitely be some help. But crop insurance don't pay for everything. You know, when you get a little further east than me, getting more towards the coast, those guys are, they're still flooded. And so we've lost millions of chickens in the state. A lot of hog lagoons have spilled over. And so it's just been, it's been a disaster upon disaster. Agriculture is our number one industry in this state. And the part of the hurricane that it did hit is probably the largest agriculture part of the state. With our confinement pigs, our confinement chickens, and, you know, we still got soybeans in the field, sweet potatoes are in the field, cotton is still in the field. They're estimating billions of dollars of agriculture loss to the state.
Yeah, Secretary Perdue, I guess, was in North Carolina yesterday getting briefed on the situation.
Yep.
So some of the fields are still inundated, are still flooded. Obviously, there's been devastation to many of the livestock producers. Like, what is the farm community asking for?
Well, that's any assistance as possible. I mean, there's still some people who are not even in their houses. And agriculture means a lot to this state. And so the agriculture community kind of rallies together. So there's been farmers from our area trucking hay and feed down to farmers further east. And so it's really been like a huge community effort to make sure these guys kind of get back on their feet. But, you know, we had Hurricane Matthew 2 years ago. So a lot of these people just got back on their feet. And here comes another hurricane. And so it's kind of one of those things where you get the farm back to normal and everything seems to be working right. But now here goes another storm.
During Matthew, was the same part of the state impacted? And were there changes made after Matthew that have had any benefit during Florence?
Obviously, Hurricane Matthew was it was a different type of storm. We didn't have so much wind, but we had a lot of water. We were still in, a lot of things are still being constructed. You know, they're trying to shore up a lot of, you know, river banks and things like that. But moving forward, I mean, there's a huge conversation needs to be held as far as, you know, how do we prepare farms for storms and how do we kind of brace ourselves? Because, you know, every time it seems like it's that much more devastating. So I know the state is having conversations about, you know, how do we, you know, better prepare ourselves on the farm for these storms?
So with a situation on livestock operations, I've been reading in the news about the lagoons overflowing and failing with breaches. What is the impact for other producers when those events occur?
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously, North Carolina is the second largest pork producer in the country. So we have a lot of pork being produced there. So that means we have a lot of waste. And when these lagoons breach, it contaminates water systems. And so it makes the water, obviously, non-drinkable, obviously. And so it's one of those things where if you're downstream of that, I mean, ramifications can be pretty hard. So that's a big question that a lot of people are starting to have the conversation about, you know, are these farms in the best location? Is that the best way to produce animals when these farms are closer to the coast? And so these lagoons are, if you've never seen one before, they're pretty big. They're normally already high as it is. And so when you get this much rain, they just spill over. And so if you were down without water, it can have huge impact, you know, on your production. For, you know, the next coming year, because obviously all that wastewater is now in your field.
I guess I'm just wondering, what sort of balance do you see there? Like, what, I mean, this, the current way of raising these animals is not only putting communities at risk and other producers at risk, but also these farmers at risk, these business owners at risk. What is the conversation there? Like, how is the farm community sort of balancing those concerns right now?
That's a good question, Lindsay. It depends on what community you're in. So we try not to demonize the, you know, the large corporate farmers, because they're farmers just like I am. But it is, I think it's starting to kind of have that conversation, is this the best way to raise animals?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you have over 5 million chickens died, that is probably an animal welfare concern, obviously. And the fact that, you know, these lagoons keep spilling over, we have to get to a point of having a conversation where we are not demonizing these guys, but we're kind of strategizing in a way that we make farming better for our environment, you know, until, you know, we really start to see the effects. And I think now, with this many chickens that have died, it's not just a huge loss to the farmer, but it's a sad story. And when you look at the corporate farm model, me personally don't think that's a good idea as a young farmer, definitely not. But a lot of these guys, I mean, they take this up personal. You know, so a lot of them try their best to inundate their farms so they won't have these, you know, catastrophic events. But at the same time, we have that many chickens in a chicken house and the water comes in there, you can only, you know, kind of brace yourself for the worst. And so I think that, you know, at the state level, and even at the national level, we need to start having that conversation of, number one, if you are going to do confinement operations, where is the best place to place them in? You know, because placing them near the coast is probably not the best idea. And then number two, how do we, you know, when we do have a catastrophic event, how are we mitigating the risk of not just the farm, but the people around the farm? You know, we have two rivers, the Cape Fear River and the Neuse River, are one of the two of the most polluted rivers in the country. And that's because of these storms, and that the hog waste kind of flows into these water sheds all the time when we do have these catastrophic weather events. As you look at the future of, you know, not just recovery, but after we get past the recovery part, I think that's going to be a huge question of, you know, how do we do this in the future, and, you know, how do we best go about, you know, our farming practices are definitely the main question.
Are some of those conversations coming and starting with and being led by any of the hog producers? But are you starting to hear some movement within the farmer community to talk about, like, how are we going to do this differently?
It's hard. The conversation gets so heated so quick just because, you know, you're coming at their way of life. It's hard to have a room full of farmers and say, you know what, guys, what y'all doing is totally wrong. That's not a conversation
ender, yeah, right there.
Yeah, and so it's one of the things that I feel like on the sustainable side of the farming community, we have the better job in that vilifying these guys, so we can have the conversation. I think one reason why we're not having the conversation is because it's like you have two different sides of the fence. You know, one side says everything you're doing is wrong, and the other guy is saying, well, this is how I feed my family. But I do think these guys want to be able to do their farms better. You know, they want to be able to brace themselves for these weather events. But I think as climate change steadily affects North Carolina more and more, I think we need to really look inward to ourselves and figure out, you know, can we sustain these operations? How many of these lifetime storms can you get in one lifetime to the point where these farms may not exist if you keep doing this? You know, because one thing about the land where we're at is it's very sandy, so we flood pretty quickly. So it doesn't take much rain for us to
flood.
Yeah,
what does repair look like? So you have flooding in a house, you have all these dead animals that you have to dispose of one way or another. So you have to clean out the whole house, I guess.
Yeah, so you have to obviously you get the chickens out. Most times they can burn them in an incinerator or they can bury them. Once you do have all that waste in there, you have to either get like a sawdust-like material to kind of absorb some of that water that's in the house so you can get up there and, you know, take a skid there and get all the manure out. But it takes a lot of 18-wheelers to do that. you know.
18-wheelers, you mean full of manure?
No, full of just the, when the house is out wet, you have to soak up that moisture. So they use sawdust a lot of times to soak up that moisture.
Some of these farmers were tobacco farmers, right? Like there's been some shift, right? Like from tobacco to some of these confinement operations?
Some of these guys did go from tobacco to poultry. There is a moratorium on hog houses, so there won't be no new hog houses built. But I mean, we are steadily building more chicken houses, it seems like all the time in these eastern counties. Yep, and some of these counties are some of the poorest counties in the state. It seems like the hurricane always hits the most poverty-stricken areas from North Carolina. And when these areas can barely recover the first time, I think at this point, the conversation needs to be, how do you support these communities better with, you know, resources they need to be more sustainable?
Mm.
My question that I have for most of these counties is, how many chicken houses can one county support? Not from the standpoint of the people who work in them, but from the standpoint of the environment. They only dump so much chicken litter on the field, you know, because the issue with chicken litter in the sand is the sand has a huge leaching factor to it. You know, so it leaches in that water, and that leak, and that waste is going where? In your water system. And so, you know, it begs the question of, are we even looking at that?
Does that leaching impact the groundwater?
In some parts, yes, it does. And it impacts, you know, your field, you know. And so when you are, as a young farmer, just reaching looking for land, you have to be very careful. You have to take a lot of soil samples to figure out, you know, has this been a field that has been, you know, steadily had manure put on it? Because if it does, you may have a high capacity of heavy metals and phosphorus in your soil.
Well, Davon, we're going to be interested to know, like, how these conversations evolve. It's so complicated and important. Like, is there a sustainable path there where you're not, you know, compromising precious natural resources, consumer health, or like as you were talking about the soil? There's a lot at stake. Are people talking about like continuing that conversation? Is there a community of farmers and advocates that are like thinking about alternatives here and sort of like the change that's necessary?
The conversations are being had, and I think that the impact is starting to, you know, be so severe that they have had, you know, new ways of doing things. I think the whole thing of turning the waste into a fuel source is, I think, really important. It's going to be slow. I mean, it's not going to be, you know, overnight changes. I think the changes will come. It's just going to take some time.
So what's next for you on your farm? Do you have grapes left to sell after the storm?
Yeah, our grape season is pretty much over. This weekend, we will probably harvest another 600 pounds of wine grapes that didn't get blown off. But after that order, we're probably much done. I think it's about 600 pounds we'll do this weekend. And these will go to a cider maker for her to put in she'll make a muscovine cider out of it. But after that, it's pretty much our season's over with. And so it's kind of devastating. We normally don't stop this early. I mean, it's still pretty early in the season.
When is the typical end of your season?
We normally go into October, you know, second week in October normally. You know, we've waited all these months for these grapes, and now we don't even have them. And so this is why, number one, I have an off-the-farm job. And number two, moving forward, we have to develop more income streams to be able to sustain our farm. You know, we just can't monocrop and just say, we're just grape farmers, because that's not going to work.
On the new farm, are you going to be growing grapes again and trying other crops as well?
Yes, yeah, so our plan right now is we will start putting in grapes. We will start, you know, constructing a vineyard this fall and winter. I plan to do blackberry. We will get sheep back on the farm. And then we will look at doing annual vegetable production, which is will be a little new to me because I've never really grown annual vegetables on a commercial scale. So we just have to be really, really thoughtful on crop selection and, you know, how we market these products as well.
Is your new farm, is it nearby your old farm? Are you staying in the Sand Hills region?
Yep, I'm about 12 minutes away. And the one reason for that is that was the most affordable farmland I could buy. So that land was like at $2,500 an acre. And the land that I'm on now is like, you know, $6,000 to $10,000 an acre, which we couldn't afford. For us to be able to take our run at farming, you know, we had to kind of think a little differently on, you know, where we want to be.
And do you think on that operation, you're going to be able to be resilient in the face of storms like this? Do you feel like that it's situated in a place that is at lower risk for flooding, or is that something that you're worried about?
So actually, this property has a higher risk of flooding, and so that's obviously not good. And I visited that property during the hurricane, and yeah, we got to be really smart on how we do things.
Was it flooded?
Yeah, the main road going into the farm, you couldn't even get in. Even though I had a pretty big truck, I still couldn't get in it. But the field was okay. But it's one of those things that when I was looking for land, I just wanted a big field. I didn't want no trees because of this whole risk of hurricane. Now, that's kind of good and bad because in a vineyard, you kind of need windbreaks on both sides of your vineyard to slow the wind down. Well, I had no windbreaks, obviously. And so we'll see. It'll be interesting to see how we kind of face climate change head on. And we've been talking about that, you know, since the storm as a family on, you know, how do we maybe want to do things different, how we may want to orientate our roads differently. You know, we've even changed the way we're building our house. We're raising our foundation. And so all these changes kind of occurred just because of this storm.
Wow. Well, I guess in some ways it forces you to plan ahead.
It does.
There's a lot of young farmers that are only able to buy land that is at greater risk of flood events and even in floodplains, right? Because that's where it's less expensive. But man, it's just like they're so vulnerable and more vulnerable these days too because of that.
And I think the question asked, you know, are we asking young farmers to do too much?
Yes. I think clearly yes. But yeah.
America says, you know, yeah, we need more farmers. We don't have enough farmers, they're aging out. But as America, are we doing enough to get new farmers on the land? And I would say the answer to that is no. Because for us to spend, well, probably, I mean, we're estimating to spend about $425,000 and we're under the age of 30. That is a huge risk for anybody. If this is what we're asking young farmers to do at this rate, how many young people are willing to spend close to $500,000 on farming? I feel like, you know, as an agriculture community, we need to really ask ourselves, you know, what are we asking here? You know, and without, you know, depending on how this farm bill shapes up, it just doesn't look good. I mean, I hate to be a Debbie Downer, but I really do. And I just think, you know, at the rate that we need new farmers, we have to have an easier way to get them on the land, definitely.
One of the things in this next farm bill, you know, all of the fights are about these existing programs and SNAP benefits and just like status quo and not a whole lot on these new challenges and taking them seriously and helping deal with the cost of land and getting farmers on the land that they need to be climate resilient and dealing with issues of student debt and the like that make the situation so much worse. Davon, thank you so much for your time today. And
yeah, no problem.
I know that you're going to be part of the conversation, at least in North Carolina. Thank you so much for your time and, you know, wishing you the best of luck as you, I guess, clean up from this season and start your new operation. It'll be exciting to hear about what's next for you.
Thanks so much, Lindsay. I appreciate it.
Davon, thank you so much for sharing with us today. We wish you best for the next season. And I'm really excited to see what's going to happen on your new land that you're going to own. So exciting. If you like the show, please tell someone about it, or you can also tell us what you think in iTunes, whether you like it or whether you don't. This show was recorded with the generous help of Radio Kingston and was edited by Hannah Beal. See you next week.